भद्रं कर्णेभिस्सुनियामदेवाः भद्रं पश्येमाक्षभिर्यजत्राः स्थिरैरङ्गैस्तुष्टुवागंसस्तनूभिः व्यसेमदेवहिदं यदायुः स्वस्ति न इन्द्रो वृद्धश्रवाः स्वस्ति नः पूषा विश्ववेदाः स्वस्ति नस्ताक्षो अरिष्टनेमिः स्वस्ति नो बृहस्पतिर्दधातु ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः हरिः ॐ सो द लास्ट् चाप्टर् आफ् दिस् टेक्स्ट् माण्डविककारिका ईस् कोल्ड् अलातशान्तिप्रकरणं मीन्स् It is named after one particular metaphor that the great philosopher Gaudapada uses to explain the unreality, or rather the relativity, of the empirical life and experiences. This is a unique example given here. Well, the example is taken from one interesting phenomenon. The philosopher is trying to prove that the unreality of waking state experiences and the unreality of dream experiences is the same from the highest perspective. And he comes to the conclusion. It is sometimes called the ontophenomenology of Mandukya-Karika approach, means the ontological status of phenomenal world, empirical world, establishing that it is essentially, from an absolute point of view, unreal. It is a very daring approach and very difficult to understand. So the metaphor, I shall try to explain the metaphor. The metaphor is called alata. Alata is a fire brand or a lighted torch. You suppose you light a torch you swing a fire brand or a lighted torch in your hands. You swing in a round shape, then we may have the illusion of an effulgent cycle. And if you swing in a different direction, you may feel, or you can give the wrong impression to an onlooker, that there is a square made of lighted torch. It's something very effulgent. And if you go on swimming, you can make different shapes, which you may call different names, squares, cycles, and so on, or a straight line. And if you stop swinging the lighted torch, then what happens? All gone. So like that, the whole world is nothing but a phenomenon created by forms which we call by different names. This is the fundamental philosophy. It is the highest reach of Advaitic experience and also philosophical speculation. The one interesting point is, from one perspective, you may think this is absolutely right, because everyone knows that this phenomenal world, this empirical universe, is nothing but just a permutation, combination, and formulation of different forms, different shapes, and so you call different names. The example again, from gold, the goldsmith may manufacture different ornaments, round in shape, small and big, different forms. And depending upon the shape and the size, you may give different names to those golden ornaments, or you may make many pots and pans and glasses from the same clay. Now, why do you have to give different names? You have to give different names because they have different shapes and forms and different utility value. You don't use a big jar to drink water. You need a glass or a cup. And you need a big jar, a clay jar made of clay, to store water. So different utility value. In Vedanta is called, you know, prayogya buddhi, or what you call utility value. And depending upon different forms and utility value, you give different names. Like that, Vedanta looks upon the entire empirical phenomena as so many pots and pans made from the same clay. You give different names because they are different, they are of different shapes. So you have to distinguish one shape, one form from another form. If everything is of the same shape and size, then you don't need different names. Name is only used to distinguish one from the other. Now, coming back to the golden ornaments, let us say, before the goldsmith started working, there were no ornaments, only gold. And if the goldsmith eventually melts them all into gold, then also golden ornaments cease to exist, the gold remains. So gold is at the beginning and gold is at the end. Golden ornaments do not exist at the beginning before the goldsmith started working, and golden ornaments do not exist when he melts. Or if you take the example of clay, before the pot maker started his work, it was clay. And after he breaks all the pots, then they all go back to clay. So when were they existing as different from clay in the case of pots and pans made of clay, or as different ornaments in the case of gold? They, even when the golden ornaments were kept for sale in the gold jewelry, then also it is gold. And before the goldsmith starts working, it was gold. And after he melts it, it's again gold. So there were no ornaments anytime. In the sense, they do not have an existence independent of gold. The pots and pans of clay do not have an existence independent of clay. So that is explained in a few verses. I'm taking a few verses from different chapters in an interconnected way, because this is, remember, these great texts, they are not written like a novel from stage 1, 2, 3 like that. So to understand, you technically, according to traditional schools, you cannot explain one verse till you master all the 215 verses. You cannot really teach one verse of Gita unless you master all the 700 verses. Not memorization. Memorization even animals can do. Parrots will do. Unless you understand the real implication of all the 700 verses, a traditional scholar will tell you, you cannot teach even one sloka. That's why a professor can teach mathematics. He should know more than what is prescribed for the kindergarten student or primary school. So, what I mean to say, so I am taking different examples. So, the verse is given in the Alatha Shanti Prakaranam, that is the section or chapter dealing with the extinction of firebrand. That's the literal meaning of Alatha Shanti. Alatha means lighted torch or firebrand. Shanti means extinction. I mean, you go on swinging and you stop swinging. So, the verse is this. Alate spandamane vai nabhasa anyato bhava. Natato anyatra nispanda nalatam pravishantite. Before that, aspandamanam alatam anabhasa majam yatha aspandamanam vijnanam anabhasa majam tatha. This is 43rd, 44, 49 is one. Alate spandamane vai nabhasa anyato bhuva. na tato anyatra nispanda na alatam pravishanti te. So when this firebrand spandamani means when it's moving, you just imagine you hold a lighted torch in your hand and it moves, you move it in different ways. So you can move and it may appear to form a cycle. You may move in a different direction and it may appear to form a street, a stick, a street line, whatever it is. So that is spandamani alate means when the firebrand lighted torch is moving in different directions, then what happens? Na abhasa anyato bhuva. What happens, you know, when you move the lighted torch, these forms appear to emerge. They are not coming from outside and entering the lighted torch. The lighted torch itself appears to take different shape as you swing it in your hand, and then you see it is forming a circle, it is forming a straight line, or it is forming a square. So these forms do not come from outside the lighted torch and enter the lighted torch. No, the lighted torch itself creates this illusion of forming different shapes and forms, which means they emerge from the lighted torch itself. And again, as you swing, you may suddenly stop. Natato anyatra nispanda na latam pravishantite. Not only that, suppose you stop swinging the lighted torch or the firebrand, then what happens, you know, then these forms do not go away from the lighted torch and enter something else. So the whole point is, this world doesn't come from anywhere and it doesn't go anywhere. What does it mean? Coming back to the example of golden ornaments. When you manufacture different ornaments from gold, the round shape of a necklace or maybe something else, these forms, round forms, do not come from outside and enter the gold. And when you melt them, these forms do not go away from the gold and go somewhere else. So where do they emerge? From gold and within gold. And where do they disappear? Towards gold. So where was actually these forms? The forms as independent ontological entity never had any existence. That is the ontophenomenology. It never had any existence. So that's why this is from the Alata Shanti Prakaranam. That is 49th verse. Alate spandamane vai na abhasa anyato bhuvaha na tato anyatra nispanda na alatam pravishanti te tataha anyatra nagachanti means these forms do not go away from the lighted torch and go somewhere else. And also, when you start swinging, these forms do not come from outside and enter the lighted torch. It is coming from the lighted torch. It's just like the forms of a golden ornament doesn't come from outside and enter the gold. And again, when you melt it, the form doesn't go away from the gold and go somewhere else. It never happens. Like that, the world doesn't really come into existence from anything. Therefore, it doesn't go away. First of all, it should come, then only it should go. So, here we have to remember, of course, this is a simple description in the Vedantic tradition or Indian philosophical tradition. There are different schools of thought, different approaches in the analysis of cause-effect relationship. According to one school of thought, so there are many broad views. I'm just giving a very general classification. According to one school of thought, the effect pre-exists in cause. According to another school of thought, every cause, every effect is a new creation. It does not pre-exist in cause. The school of thought, which holds the view that the effect pre-exists in cause, is called Satkaryavada. Means the karya means the effect. It already pre-exists in cause. Like for example, the round shape of a golden ornament pre-exists in gold as a potential possibility. And also in a different method, the possibility of oil pre-exists in the seed. But there are two different approaches. Both in the case of seeds and also in the case of gold, there is always this possibility of effect pre-existing in cause. But how the effect evolves, there is a difference. In the case of oil coming from seed, the seed evolves, transforms, permanently changes its properties, everything, into oil. Because the oil cannot back to the seed form. So, the oil and seed can coexist. They have the same level of ontological reality. It is called Parinamavada, the school of evolution, which is accepted by the Sankhyas, Yogas, Ramanujites, and also Madhva system, and Brahma Parinamavada. It's called, you know, Brahman, the ultimate reality, really transforms itself into this universe and the individual souls. And roughly speaking, the Genesis Bible approaches this view, the real transformation of Parinamavada. But Vedantins and the school of Buddhist idealists, the Shunyavada school, they believe that the cause does not really become the effect. The cause only appears to become the effect. It's called the doctrine of transfiguration. It's a word used in modern English interpretations, which is not fully accepted or acceptable to traditional scholars, because transfiguration causes some other concerns when the opposing philosophical schools. Anyway, to be very brief, because there's no time to focus on that aspect. There are innumerable schools of thought. There are schools of thought which believe that every new creation is a new creation. Say, for example, Nayayikas, Vaisheshikas, materialists, the school of Indian atomism called Vaisheshikas, and Indian school of logic called Nayayikas, they all believe that every effect is a new creation. They refuse to accept any connection between a thread and a cloth that is made from thread. They refuse to accept any connection or relationship, cause-effect connection between gold and golden ornament. Every golden ornament is a new creation. It's called Arambhavada. I mean, the doctrine that holds the view that every effect is a new creation, which is in a way ridiculous, but then they have their own arguments, because they believe you don't carry a golden piece on your head or in your neck. You need a goldsmith to convert the gold into a golden ornament, and you need to do that in a particular way. So vyavahara buddhi, it needs another utilitarian value. You need a different shape, different form, then only you can make use of the gold as an ornament. So it's something totally new. That's their view, which Vedantins won't accept. It may be a new entity, but you melt it, goes back to gold. Also Madhva system, they all believe that every new effect is a new creation. So, there is a utility value. Clay cannot be used for drinking water. You need a pot maker to change that clay into a glass, then only you use it for drinking water. So it's a new entity. But Vedantins will tell you that's true. That is true. But then you break it and goes back to clay. And before he made it a pot, it was clay. So this existence, the different ontological reality is only superimposition that appears to be real for the time being, at present. So these are different schools. Satkaryavada, Satkaryavada, Arabhavada. I'm not going to those details, but you have to keep this in mind to understand the next verse which I'm going to discuss in support of the idea of non-origination of the universe, which is a distinct philosophical contribution of Gaudapada to world thought. Of course, it is originally there in the Upanishads, but he was the first one who to articulate it in so many words. So he says, Ado ande chayan nasti vartamane abhitattatha vidadhai sadrisha santu abhitatha iva lakshita. This is a famous verse. Something that doesn't exist at the beginning and at the end. Again, you know the pot. You break it, there's no pot. And before the pot maker made it a pot, it was a clay. So the pot as such doesn't exist at the beginning. And the pot doesn't exist at the end. Then when does it exist? When the pot is sitting there on your table in which you hold some water to drink. At that time also the pot or the glass is not different from the clay. So before the pot maker or made it, transformed the clay into a glass or a pot, it was clay. And after some time, if this is a chance of breaking it, it going back to clay, then also it is clay. There is no pot, there is no glass. Then when did it exist? When it's sitting in front of you. At that time, it doesn't have an existence independent of clay. The golden ornament that you're wearing in your neck doesn't have an ontological reality independent of gold. It was gold before the goldsmith made it. An ornament, it will be gold when he melts it. So when you are wearing it your neck, then also it is gold. As an ontological entity, it doesn't have an independent status. That's what Gaudapada says. Now, how does it relate to our philosophy? Gaudapada says the world when it's existing in front of you, maybe this lake or the mountains or whatever you see, the food you eat, everything. They do not have an independent existence, independent of Brahman, Atman. Because they exist in front of you as a manifestation of name and form. So in fact, the world in which we are living, if you look at the world, after removing this matrix or the prison or the glass of name and form and causation, the world you are living, the world you are experiencing, the world in which you are interacting with others is non-different, non-distinct from Brahman. The whole problem arises, you know. This is a wonderful idea, but you should remember, it is only an idea for the beginner. It should become an experience. And for experience, we need to go through certain training, certain process. First of all, very often we are not able to translate an idea or a concept into an experience for one simple reason. We do not take it seriously. At the empirical level, we take things seriously. But at philosophical level, very often, we approach the subject as an idea. Here, I have to point out one fundamental difference. Vedanta is essentially not a philosophical system. Vedanta is fundamentally a level of spiritual experience. See, you may be called a Kantian if you teach critical purists in a university. You may be called a utilitarian if you teach J.S. Mill or Bentham. If you may be called an evolutionist if you teach Darwin in a university. At least that's what it used to be. Now nobody bothers about J.S. Mill and others. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm talking about an early era where there were, in university, there were utilitarians, there were British empiricists, there were German idealists, there were Kantians. They didn't do anything except teaching Kant's critical purism. That's all. Now, just by being impressed by Vedanta idea, you don't become a Vedantin. For that, we have to travel, we have to undertake a journey from concept to experience, a journey, an evolution from an idea to real experience. This is possible through one important instrument, that's a sense of sanctity. See, very often when you approach an idea in a casual form, with a casual approach, we reach only the surface, the most superficial thing. And often I have seen the wonderful idea. Wonderful idea is not very different from seeing a wonderful ice cream. But really speaking, what people need, what Vedanta students need, is a sense of sanctity, a sense of sacredness to what we learn and to the idea, to the tradition that we, that gives us this idea. See, when you develop this kind of sanctity or sacredness, there is a great transformation taking place in our mind. Many of the barriers, many of the cynical doubts, intellectual irritants, bitterness, all will vanish when you approach the subject as something sacred, something coming from an ancient tradition, something that has to do with my spiritual evolution. It is not something that gives us a philosophical conviction. It's spiritual evolution. So this sanctity or this sacredness is the first important factor that is needed even to intellectually understand Vedanta correctly. Philosophy you can learn, chemistry, mathematics, everything can learn. But for learning Vedanta, you need this kind of sanctity, sacredness. And this sacredness, it prepares our mind, our emotions, our intellect for understanding this great spiritual idea. That's the first qualification required. Secondly, we must have a strong desire for higher transcendental wisdom. A strong desire for liberation. It's called mumukshutvam. Mumukshu is one who is seeking liberation. So people who, you know, people who have everything going on fine, still if you feel an inner discontent, inner dissatisfaction, that's a qualification. In fact, in Patanjali system, it is called Parinama Dukkha. So there is one sutra in Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, Parinama Tapa Samskara Dukkhehi Gunavisheshacha Dukkhameva Sarvam Vivekinaka. This is the sutra. So Parinama Tapa Samskara Dukkhehi. So I shall focus on one thing. Some very called Parinama Dukkha. Parinama Dukkha, according to Vyasa and other commentators of Patanjali, is a feeling of inner dissatisfaction that comes to a noble soul when he has got a very wonderful job, when he has plenty of money in the bank, a plenty of all the desirable things fulfilled at the empirical level. Still you feel a need for something higher and transcendental. That is called Parinama Dukkha. So Dukkha, literal translation of Dukkha, if you read Apter, Monier Williams, it is mean grief. So very often, you know, Buddha's philosophy is in a very superficial way interpreted for grief. Buddha was not at all grief-stricken. Buddha was born as a rich man. He was a prince, the son of a king. And he never knew anything like old age, death, or sickness, or any such problem. He didn't get a picture of the undesirable things of life. And this man was, he had all things fulfilled. But when he saw a dead man's body, a sick man, and also an old man, so the problems, the imperfections of life, like old age, death, and sickness, he did something totally unexpected and unknown to him. That made him think, is there something other than living like a prince in a luxurious palace with plenty of money, retainers, and servants? And he left his kingdom that night. And he had a wife, He had a little son, and he walked 1200 miles, reached Bodh Gaya, sat under the tree, and he, according to Lalita Vistara, which gives a picture of Buddha's life, Ikhasane Sushyadu Me Shariram Tugasti Mamsam Che Vilayam Che Yatuhu Aprapi Siddhim Bhu Janma Durlabham Naivasanat Kayam Antaschalishyade. This is a verse in the Lalita Vistara. He says, you know, Buddha sat under the tree with a strong vow, determination, I won't get up from this seat till I get the answers to my fundamental questions. Amen. Till I reach the highest spiritual realization, I won't get up from this seat. Let my body, let my blood, let my everything go into pieces. I won't get up. Now, why did he do that? He was not miserable. See, when you have no money and you work hard, you are grieved, you have grief. But that grief has a kind of, I mean, wretchedness about it, feeling miserable. Buddha was not miserable. Buddha did not have a wretched feeling about it. But then it's called dukkha. So what is the dukkha? So Vyasa in his commentary says, Pratikula, he says, you know, the parinama dukkha da nama, he defines this parinama dukkha. He says, it is something that happens only to yogis. It means highly advanced, noble souls alone will feel the need for a higher wisdom even when they have no problem at the empirical world, empirical level. Plenty of money, everything is there. Still you feel the need for something higher, and this happens only to a spiritual person, spiritually oriented person. That is called mumukshutvam, or the aspiration for higher spiritual life. And this is a very much, this is a very important prerequisite for every student of Vedanta. Because when we have this intense desire for higher transcendental wisdom, it opens a new nerves in our body. Our mind suddenly develops a new sensitivity. Our intellect suddenly soars to a higher region. It develops a fitness, a capacity to understand higher spiritual ideas. And then you know what happens? And then we must practice Yama Niyamas, Ahimsa, Satya, Asteya, Brahmacharya, Parigraha. Then we must practice unselfishness, purity of mind, etc. This we do, if we do, then if not in this life, next life, we will reach the highest goal. So this is an important point, remember. It is not a matter of conviction. As you are convinced that J.S. Mill is right, also you teach J.S. Mill's book, you are branded as a utilitarian in university. You teach Kant, you are called a Kantian. Or if you call Karl Marx, you may be called a Marxist economist, or things like that. You cannot become a Vedantin like that. Very often, this aspect is not properly appreciated in outside the traditional circles of Vedanta thinkers, Vedanta students. So first is a kind of sacredness, sanctity. We should approach this subject, and we should approach this tradition, this is a great tradition. So that's why Vivekananda said, if you develop this quality, this Vedantic temperament, then if you read the Bible, then you get all the hidden diamonds, the great universal wisdom of Bible becomes clear to you. You may belong to another tradition. If you read the Buddhist scriptures, then you understand the universal spiritual tradition of Buddhism. So whatever religious book, holy book, if you read, you will understand the hidden gems of universal spiritual wisdom. With this Vedantic approach, if you read Grand Inquisitor in Brothers Karamazov, you'll be able to read a higher spiritual wisdom behind the fantasy poem in a Grand Inquisitor. You find the real meaning of Jesus' crucifixion, his return, all will be clear to you if you read the Grand Inquisitor. It's a part of a novel, you know, maybe possibly the greatest novel ever written. Dostoevsky's Grand Inquisitor. So this sacredness, this sanctity, sense of sanctity, sacredness, that tears down all walls, prison walls of skepticism, doubt, and so on. So that's an important point, remember. Now, in fact, in this context, I can just refer to one interesting episode in the Gita. In the Gita, Arjuna puts one question to Krishna. That's a very simple question. Will we take up a spiritual ideal in our life and we pray and we meditate, and if we do not fully succeed, people may perhaps die, or they may have a deviation in this life itself, a distraction. There could be so many causes. You may be transferred to another place, so you won't be able to connect with higher spiritual ideal of Vedanta. Like that, many things could happen. Any kind of deviation or distraction. So what does it mean in the life of a spiritual seeker? All your efforts will go in vain. I mean, your life will practically will fail. That's the question that Arjuna puts to Krishna. Ayadi siddhayopedu yoga chalida manasaha aprapya yoga samsiddhim kam gatim Krishna gachvi. What is going to be the fate of such people? That's the question. In answer to this, Lord Krishna gives an answer. Even if you practice meditation just a few times in your life, or read a scripture, a great scripture with the sense of sanctity, integrity and honesty, or have a casual acquaintance with the higher spiritual philosophy, and you did try your best to practice but did not always succeed, even according to you, then also there is no room for disappointment. That is the essence of Krishna's answer. Partha naiveha namutra vinashas tasya vidyate nahi kalyana kud kaschid durgadim tadagacchati. Means anyone who does a little effort, a little, that will produce a spiritual capital. And when we are born again, we will be able to make use of the results of our spiritual practices in this life. I mean, we'll be born with this inherited wealth, that is spiritual wealth, impressions, vasanas, vrittis, samskaras, all that we have already accumulated in previous life. And with that, you'll be able to connect or reconnect with our tradition, with the spiritual practices, and continue our journey from where we left it in the last life. So, tatratam buddhisam yogam labhade paurvadekikam. That's the mystery why people feel a great attraction towards an ideal, a spiritual ideal, which logically we cannot explain. See, if you use the yardstick of modern logic as used in mathematics or physics, very often we may not be able to get a satisfying answer to this question unless we approach it from a different perspective. For example, if somebody tells you that this lake is not real, or this body is not real, wealth is not real, success is not real, it's difficult to intellectually approach it. But there are people who quickly understand. Now, what makes the difference? Maybe the one who understands may have lesser IQ. So it is not a matter of IQ that you should correct very clearly. It's a matter of our own spiritual evolution. IQ has nothing at all to do with in spiritual life. IQ, some kind of IQ is necessary. It doesn't mean that dullness is a qualification for becoming spirit. Not at all. That's not the meaning. What I mean to say, intellectual reasoning power can sometimes be a big burden. You know, after 180 degrees, skepticism comes backward. It questions you. You know, reading Jagasumurthy's life, what happens to people. So, some kind of intellectual skepticism, which is misdirected, which comes back to you, directed at you, 180 degrees comes back to you, it can be destructive. So, what is needed? Intellect refined and conditioned by Shraddha. Now this Shraddha, a sense of sanctity that we attach to great spiritual values, is an inherited wealth that comes from your own previous life. You have acquired it. That's why when we go to people, when they have some need, they feel like going to some spiritual place. So feel like reading a spiritual work to get answers, to get satisfaction. Other people may go to some other, they may take some other means which may help them to forget a problem, but only for the problem to return in their in more magnified form. So, this sense of sanctity is actually is a manifestation of this inherited spiritual capital. When we do noble deeds, when we think noble thoughts, when we speak noble deeds, even a little bit of practice creates a spiritual wealth, spiritual capital. And that is transferred from life to life. Death of this body, the end of this body, is only a transition point. It is not the end of the journey. When we are born again, we inherit this spiritual wealth. And we are able to continue our journey from where we left it in the previous life. So this is what it means. So we have to remember a few things. I shall try to sum up some of the teachings. First, we must understand from Vedantic tradition, there are four levels of interpreting absolute reality. This is one point, remember. Four levels. At the lowest level, absolute unreality, because that is also an approach to reality. That is absolute unreality. Even when you read about it, when you hear it, there is a mutual contradiction in it. The example given in ancient books is, you know, the son of a barren woman, the horn of a hare, and flowers imagined to exist on the sky. These are all mutually contradictory, because if you are seeing horns, you can be sure it is not hair. If you are seeing flowers, you can be sure it is not on the sky, it is in the garden. So the very expression itself is mutually contradictory. It is called absolutely unreal. This is one at the lowest level. At the highest level, absolute reality. And what is the absolute reality? The absolute reality is something that always existed, that never comes into existence, because to come into existence is a transition from a state of non-existence to existence. It's always existed, so it cannot come into existence. And for that very reason, it cannot disappear. So existence, non-existence, growth, evolution, decay, death, all these do not apply to that absolute reality, which is always there, because so it never comes into existence, so it never ceases to exist. So these are two levels, two opposite extremes. The absolute reality, where you are should be capital, absolute reality. It is absolutely real. The other one is absolute unreality. Between these two, there are two levels of interpreting reality. Below the absolute reality, there is one level called the empirical reality. Our life, all these natural phenomena, our actions of success, failures, problems, achievement, and so on. These are not absolutely unreal. Vedanta never tells you it is absolutely unreal. Vedanta only tells you it is not absolutely real, in the sense it exists for some time, maybe for some years or some millions of years or billions of years, but still it may change. So anything which is subjected to change is only relatively real. It is only empirical reality or phenomenal reality. It is not absolutely real. Below that, there is one which may exist, but only as an idea. So the example is, you know, when you see a rope in the dark room, you may mistake the rope for a snake. The snake is not absolutely unreal because you have seen the snake somewhere else. The memory is there that you superimpose upon the object you see in front of you. So these are four levels of reality. Vedanta tells you there is only one entity, one thing that qualifies for the status of absolute reality. That is Brahman or Atman. Everything else comes and goes. So this is one unique analysis of Vedanta. Now again, there are a few more ideas which I want to present before we conclude. That is, they are related to these subjects. Since we are dealing with this text, it may be of some help to us. Now, what would be approach of such a highly evolved spiritual person? Again, we should remember, it is not something that we must imitate. It would be very dangerous also. So, because the verse, if I read, it becomes clear to you. Nistudir nindamaskaro nissudhagara evacha chalachala nikedascha yadir yadrichyo bhavet. Who is a spiritual seeker who has reached this highest level of spiritual evolution? So, maybe I can give the example. If you may have read the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna, and you also hear about such advanced souls. In fact, they do not belong to the social structure as we understand. They are outside the conventional social etiquette or ideas of behavior, propriety. The idea is, you can read the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna, you find there are more than one occasions. Once a great, we call Avadhuta Paramahamsa, they move from place to place. For them, this world doesn't really exist. But they have this body, till the body falls down, they go on living this world. They are totally unconscious. They move out and they may look like madmen, abnormal even, but they are not really abnormal. So highly advanced souls will be able to recognize them. It's an extreme case. You may get a glimpse of such people even in the pre-Christian Greek tradition. Maybe Socrates in a distant, maybe a example of, a remote example of this concept. For them, what normally people consider to be proper or precious or important, it's absolutely nothing for them. Their focus is entirely on something else. Though they are living in this world, they are not living in this world. Physically, they are living in this world. But intellectually or emotionally, spiritually, they belong to another realm. Such people are frequently mentioned in the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna. On one occasion, such an advanced spiritual person came to the Ekshamisa temple. And he just took a plunge into Ganga, to cold water. He didn't remove the water drops from his body. He came and you find many interesting things. There were, you know, animals, cows and dogs, wild animals were feeding on leftover food items. And this man, who was so odd looking, went in their company, and they also didn't feel any problem, these animals. And he ate food like them. And after some time, he just went away. He didn't bother to talk to anybody. For him, the world of propriety, the world of convention did not exist. So Sri Ramakrishna, he prayed to Mother, "Mother, don't make me like this." He was on the verge of becoming something like that. So because if you become like that, you won't be able to do anything good for the world. So great spiritual seekers, great spiritual teachers, they won't live like that, because they have, apart from realizing this level of spiritual perfection, they have another responsibility. that you teach something to people around. So Sri Ramakrishna had a responsibility. He came for a different purpose. So he had a responsibility, he had to teach the ordinary human beings about spiritual life. So such a person, a wanderer, a most unconventional person, won't be able to function as teacher. Anyway, he asked Hriday to follow this man. And Hriday followed him, rather ran after him, and he didn't want this man to follow him. And he even tried to drive him out by throwing stones, but Hriday was made of sterner stuff. So he followed, and then he turned back and said only one sentence: when you stop seeing any distinction or difference between the ditch water, the dirty water flowing in the ditch, and pure Ganga water, then you have reached the highest realization. Then he went away. This is the story. I mean the historical event. Now the point is, this is not something that one should start acting upon. This is something that you reach, and many great spiritual teachers, even after reaching this stage, they do not live like that. They come back to the normal plane and they teach the world. They are the great epoch makers in the history of spiritual life. So, in fact, that is explained in this verse. Nistudihi nirnamaskaraha nisuthakara evacha chalachara niketascha yetihi yadrchigo bhavet. Yeti means a monk. Monk in the sense, it is this sort of unconventional, spiritually advanced persons. That's the meaning. They won't praise unnecessary anyone. And they won't show any respect to anyone. And they don't do any normal rituals to be performed by householders, like rituals, you know, Pitriyakya, it's called Sothagara. I mean, these are mantras to be chanted while performing rituals in memory of your departed source, your father. So that is called Nisothagara. And then, for them, this body is moving, and the Atman within the body is eternal, it is unmoving. They just follow, they don't care for anything else. The body is for them almost non-existent. So yadruchika means the one who doesn't seek anything and the one who doesn't avoid anything. So far as physical life is concerned, they live like a dry leaf floating in the current of river. For them, this life as such is just a process of coming to the end of bodily existence. Beyond that, they won't think of anything in life. This is the highest state of spiritual realization that is mentioned in this book. So we have to remember one thing. This is not common for everyone. This is one particular type of spiritually advanced souls called Paramahamsas or Avadhutas, who may not have come to this world to teach the humanity, like Vivekananda or Shankara or Buddha, like great speakers, Sri Ramakrishna, you know, the Christ. Many of the greatest spiritual seekers may have reached this state of spiritual experience, but they also have come for another purpose. They want to take the best from the ancient tradition, practice in their life, reinterpret with a new emphasis, and hand over to the next generation. This is the tradition of great teachers, acharyas and avataras, incarnations and great epoch-making teachers who also reach this stage, but they come back to the normal plane and teach the world. So the text doesn't come to an end here. This text is a very important text within a very, very short period, 9 days. Normally it takes several years for one to master this Vishankaracharya's commentary. 3 years normally it takes, with proper discussion of each prakarana, each subject discussing, because this karika, 215 karikas, is a commentary on 12 Upanishad mantras, Mandukya, And it is studied and always studied with Shankaracharya's commentary, who was the one who threw light on all these statements of Gaudapada. So thank you. Our retreat practically comes to an end today. So we have interaction for about half an hour. So you can ask any question from any part of the text, and I shall be happy to try to respond. Please.
Swami, the really lovely metaphor about the fire torch and with the gold. Something came to my mind that what's really generating the form is not the torch, it's the movement of the torch. And with the gold, the gold isn't creating the forms. It's the hands or the imagination of the goldsmith. So it seems like there's one other factor that we haven't discussed in those. Or maybe I'm asking too much of those.
No. I should try to explain. Okay, coming back to the metaphor of the torch, you know, the movement of the movement of the torch gives the illusion of some visible forms coming into existence. So those forms do not come from outside the torch, not from the movement. If you move your hand, it doesn't happen. It can happen, but you won't be able to you chase or follow the movement as you can do in the case of a torch. So the idea is, though the torch is moving, the torch doesn't lose anything or gain anything. It is still the light of torch itself.
But the torch doesn't move by itself.
Yeah, that's true. That is true. But the movement itself is something that comes and goes. The movement is not a permanent condition. The torch is permanent. Whether you hold it in your hand in a stable condition or you move, that is something subject to change. You can hold it straight, you can move, you can do a cycle, all these are possible. But the torch itself doesn't undergo any change. It doesn't produce the form, and it doesn't lose the form. So where do the forms come from? The wrong notion that a cycle is being created by the movement of the hand. The movement of the hand is only a temporary phenomenon. You move your hand in so many different ways. Anything which changes is not taken as an entity. Torch is real. The movement is not real, because you move now and you stop moving next moment. But the torch is always there. If you hold a torch straight, stable, like a stick, if you swing it, it becomes a round a cycle. Or it can come anything else. But the point is, everything depends upon the visible, effulgent, firebrand itself. I don't know if it is clear to you. The simple point, okay, I will tell you. The forms do not come from outside the torch.
I understand that.
And second, you mentioned the hand movement. Even if you do not move the hand, there is a form visible, maybe it may look like a stick.
So maybe let's look at the gold metaphor. Gold won't just become an ornament.
Yeah, that's true. But you know, here also, in fact, this is also very important. Here, the point is, there is another important point: extinction. You know, when the movement comes to an end, then the world comes to an end. So you attribute movement, which comes and goes, which is not a stable condition, to the lighted torch. When you interpret the lighter torch through movements, then you see different shapes and forms. On the other hand, even when the firebrand is moving, if you really concentrate on the firebrand itself, fully realizing the fact that these shapes are only illusory forms, then you don't see the movement. Take a cycle. A round cycle. If you focus on every millimeter point of the cycle, you see only one straight line. You bring together, then only you see the curve and the cycle. Look at the cycle and you try to focus on the... Think of a cycle formed by an infinite number of little dots. Look at the dot itself. It is straight. But these dots are kept together in a particular symmetry, you get the illusion that it's becoming a cycle. So if a person really focuses on the light, on the firebrand itself, he can look at it without seeing the cycle. But that kind of concentration is possible. It is like after realizing the highest reality, you look at this world, you won't be seeing the world. When you look at this world, after removing this matrix, the prism of name and form, then you won't be seeing this world. Apparently you are seeing this world, but what you see will be different from the world seen and experienced by people who look at it and interpret it in terms of names and forms. So an advanced soul who really understands these forms are only illusions can look at the whole phenomenon of cycles being formed by the moving firebrand. He will not be tempted. He won't think, oh, it's all, I know. He won't be seeing the cycle at all. You can look at them just as movement by a person holding a lighted torch in his hand. A Jivan Mukta liberated soul can look at this lake, these mountains, and still not see the lakes and mountains, see only Brahman. Similarly, if you can look at a cycle formed by little tiny dots, you focus your eyes on the tiny dot, you won't be seeing the cycle. For every dot is straight actually. Let us say small, tiny squares, which are straight actually, not curved. But put together in a particular way, they appear to make a cycle. But if you're convinced that it's only little, tiny squares, you won't be seeing the cycle. So, a liberated person, an enlightened person, can see somebody else this moving his hand with the lighted torch, can still very well understand, oh, actually no cycles are being formed. Nothing is happening. And the beginning, he may see this, but immediately understand, oh, it's only an illusion. Then he won't be seeing it again. Is it clear?
I think so.
Isn't gold maybe a better example? Because we all use it, you know. Yeah. A goldsmith doesn't see the ornaments. For the goldsmith, workmanship is no consideration. Because he may be planning to make some other ornament from the same gold, which is used for making a necklace. He may make something else. So far as he is concerned, only the quality of the gold matters, not the workmanship. That's the thing. Similarly, for a liberated soul, these names and forms are there, but they will be able to look beyond them or see through them. When they see through names and forms, they don't see names and forms. They are not seeing the names and forms, they are seeing through. That's the idea. Okay.
Thank you.
Yes.
Swami, this is just an example.
Yeah.
Right? So if we go too far
with
the example, trying to put more stress on the example, like, you know, whether you use a fire to melt the... So basically we have to focus on the gist of the example,
which
relates to the
particular
concept.
Yeah, an example and what the example seeks to explain, they will not be exactly equal.
Right.
Yeah, every example is an approximation, is not an equivalent to what the example seeks to illustrate.
Yeah.
So that's an important point to make. Okay.
So this, after the absolute, the relative world, right? the relative existence we can perceive by our senses.
Yeah.
So what, by what quality does the, you know, the realized soul see the absolute? He has to transcend all the senses, right? So how does he realize the...
He doesn't see that. He doesn't interpret it. Because he only experiences. And experience comes, it experiences beyond interpretation. In every interpretation, there is subject-object distinction. When you identify yourself with what you experience, then you don't interpret, you don't explain, you don't objectify. So Vedanta makes one point, every objectified knowledge, which means things that you perceive or cognize with mind and senses of perception, is non-eternal. Because the very fact that you are able to empirically see and experience shows that it is non-eternal. Anything in the empirical world is only relative, it is not eternal in that sense. Now the question arises, you know, I'm often baffled by the practical value of this great teaching in modern times. Maybe one important point to remember is, very often, as I mentioned earlier, when we see things, when we are concerned about things, when we worry about things, when we think of different things, frequently we interpret the impermanent, the empirical things as the permanent, the absolute things. So that wrong interpretation creates a lot of problems. Intellectually, we may be convinced of the impermanence of the empirical things, but that intellectual conviction doesn't translate into a life-saving philosophy. But this Vedanta is actually a life-saving philosophy, because when you understand that the absolute reality is beyond empirical phenomena, then the empirical things are there. But when we get too obsessed with that, then we'll be able to understand. Well, we'll be able to stop where we should stop. That's why Sri Ramakrishna says, keep this highest knowledge in your pocket. Of course, he doesn't use the pocket. Mm-hmm. Somewhere you keep. And when you live in this world, just try to remember as often as you can that all those things are empirical things, impermanent, they come and go. So that's a fact. That will help us even in living this world without being within the world. I mean, if life is a boat and the world is a river, then the water will not enter the boat. Rather, the boat will be on the surface of the water. So that's the real practical value of these Vedantic teachings. So that's a real
place. Swami Vivekananda went to a cave, and he met one Shunashi, and Swami Vivekananda was very hungry, and then Chadu, somewhere, just like magic, he brought one basket of all fruits. So what is the meaning of that?
You mean when Swami Vivekananda, a monk, gave him fruits? Swami Vivekananda's life is full of such events.
Yeah,
when he gets help, when he used to get help from unexpected.
Yeah, so. That fruits, from where that fruits came. And he was, Swami Vivekananda himself was very surprised.
Yeah.
To see that power of that.
Yeah. Now, that's true. Those who take to spiritual life seriously will have many such experiences which we cannot rationally explain. I don't know exactly from where the fruits came, but it's clear that it came, it is a manifestation of God's grace. That's the only way we can interpret it exactly.
Swami, actually, I just was wondering, what's the term for the level of reality where it only exists as an idea? I always miss that.
It's called Pradibhasika. In this particular story, it is called snake. See, when in the dark room, when you see, when there's a rope, if there is not enough light, the rope may be mistaken to be a snake, to be a piece of a stick or be a thin stream of water. All these are possible options. We may mistake that snake, sorry, that rope for a snake. We may mistake that rope for a snake because it resembles the shape of a snake or the color of the snake. So it is, it's only an idea. It is not absolutely unreal because you have seen it somewhere else and remains in your memory. From that memory, you superimpose it upon the object you are seeing in front of you because you don't know it is a rope. That's all. It is called pradibhasya, right? The rope itself is vyavaharika, empirical things.
Swami, I thought of that word sincerity. You know, that Nisargadatta, you know, that says that just to have that deep sincerity, which I think is a little like that sanctity you're mentioning,
true.
If you are seeking that, then that will just keep.
The sense of sanctity, it breaks down many barriers of doubt, skepticism, and also sometimes, you know, we don't want to accept certain things because we don't want to accept.
Right.
And we interpret our non-acceptance in terms of, I should be logically clear to me.
Yes.
In fact, this unwillingness to accept because we don't want to accept may be interpreted as a logical inconsistency. So, but the moment you look upon certain things as sacred, as something with the sense of sanctity, that breaks down many of these barriers of mind. And makes the mind ready, prepares the mind to go deeper in, even into a philosophical concept.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even a philosophical idea becomes more clear to you when you are imbued with this sraddha, sense of sanctity.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you wanted to ask something?
These jnanendriyas, etc., are still needed for our sadhana. And the way we transcend it, it seems to me that you had given a very good metaphor of the pole vaulter. You know, you still need the pole to transcend the target barrier. But once you transcend it, you have to let go of the mind.
You don't let go, they go up themselves.
They go.
And Sri Ramakrishna, in fact, a simile that Sri Ramakrishna gives is very important. You don't give up karmas. Karmas give you up.
Mm-hmm.
See, when Sri Ramakrishna started these rituals in the temple, he was very traditional, very conservative, very very rigid. He was so sincere. So even accept offering from Kali temple. Just imagine, he was the greatest devotee of Mother. In the beginning, he was so conservative. Okay, and then he was very careful about plucking flowers, bilwa and so on. Finally, he reached a stage where he cannot anymore pluck flowers and bilwa leaves because he saw bilwa leaves, flowers as manifestations of the same Brahman. So at that time, it became impossible for him to continue his job as a priest. So, he didn't one day, today I have real liberate, tomorrow onwards I won't do puja. It doesn't happen. I can give an example from the Gita. I mean, when we live behind a stage, not consciously, rather that particular stage is seen to be of less relevance, of less importance. So, that's why karmas leave you. You don't leave karma. So, in the Gita, there is a verse, there is a bit of humor in it. You know, yukta ahara viharasya yukta cheshtasya karmasu yukta sukna avabodhasya yoga bhavati dukha. The idea is that you should practice moderation in fasting and also in eating, in working, also in leisure. Everything you should be moderate. That's the idea. That is yoga. You should not go into extremes. Now, I have seen and I heard about people who do a lot of ascetic practices, fasting. Okay, now, I remember, I won't mention, but I remember hearing the story of a person he used to do a lot of fasting. And when the day he fasted, he becomes very bitter, angry and quarrelsome. And he will tell, see, I'm fasting and these fellows are eating like gluttons. I'm fast, look at me. So, actually what that person needs, he should eat 4 square meals every day. And then later on he should practice fasting, then he won't be bitter. People who really practice extreme asceticism, more out of his kind of, I mean, they are not up to that, you know. They have not left behind their desire for food. They have not transcended the desire for food. Rather, they just avoid it. So what happens, you know, it creates bitterness. So you say that fellow is eating like gluttony. Look at me, I'm very moderate. Actually, it leads to degradation. Instead of asceticism should make you progress, it becomes the opposite of it. So that's why it's very important. In spiritual life, there's a gradual, natural transcending, a process of transcending and stage. You transcend karma, which means karmas leave you. You don't leave karma. Sri Ramakrishna transcended that stage of formal rituals. So for him, it is physically and psychologically it impossible for him to pluck a flower from the garden because he felt even the flower is Brahman. So before that, tomorrow onwards, everything is Brahman, I won't pluck flowers. That won't work. That won't work. It is not an option that we just arbitrarily start practicing. It doesn't happen that way. And you can test whether that person really is natural or not. The fasting man's bitterness is a classic example.
So, in Gita, Swamiji, second chapter, there is that definition of a sthitaprajnaka, you know, that you give up the, but the vasana stays on.
Yeah,
right?
There
is a paragraph.
Again, giving up means we transcend it. The word used may be like giving up, but it's transcending. We go beyond it.
So, Maharaj, Shraddha and Nishtha, the same thing?
Yes, Shraddha enables you to practice Nishtha. Nishtha means with great Shraddha, with great sense of sanctity, you do certain things. Even in social family circles, this kind of sense of sanctity can play a very important role in removing many social problems, domestic problems, all this. Because people want to, they question this sense of sanctity on the basis of it is against logic, it is against reason. But people do a lot of irrational things elsewhere. So what they don't want to do, they get a justification, it is against reason. This sense of sanctity of human relations, family relations, social obligations, all these can play very creative, constructive role, even in keeping our civilization and culture stable. That's important. Okay, so we had a wonderful retreat. Thank you for interaction
thank
and questions.
You thank, you.
Thank, you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Om Shanti 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 Harihi Om Tat Sat Sri Ramakrishna Panamastu.